antenna screwed up a little bit, and the antenna won't go. And so we're going to have to use the low bandwidth command link antenna to send signals back from Saturn to send us the pictures. This actually happened. So we're going to reprogram the computer so that it will send us the best possible pictures of Saturn using the minimum number of bits. That's the goal. Now, you've heard that FedEx commercial? When it absolutely positively has to be there overnight? I mean, imagine that I send a picture from Saturn that I take with my digital camera, right? How many people have been to Saturn? Right? So this is an expensive picture, and imagine that it gets lost on the way back. Now, how could it get lost on the way back? It's a digital camera, so it's a digital picture. It's a bunch of ones and zeros. And you remember I told you the thing that's good about digital, particularly for the missiles that they originally developed it for, is that it doesn't get screwed up by all those little temperature changes. Right? So the zeros remain zeros, the ones remain ones. Even if the voltage shifts a little bit, it's still a zero or one, right? Well, that's good news and bad news. It's like the little girl that when she was good, she was very, very good. But when she was bad, she was terrible. Horrid. Got it? So that's what happens. You know this. You have a hard drive. A hard drive is just a way of communicating not with Saturn, but with the future, right? You put stuff into the hard drive, and you can take it out in the future. That's all that's going on. It's communication just like with Saturn. What happens is sometimes you put stuff in, and then when you get ready to take it out, it's gone. You see, in our physical existence, things end before they break. You look at this and you say, ooh, don't go further. It might break. Right? And then it breaks. But it bends before it broke. Right? So that's what you're used to. With digital things, the things are zero that are supposed to be zero right up until the time they're one. At which point they're one. So when they break all the way. Right? They have two states, perfect and perfectly wrong. Okay, so what's the basic problem? Let's abstract away from this. I'm at Saturn, and I want to communicate with people on Earth. I'm not a real person, I'm just a computer. But I want to send things to people on Earth. Now, I'm paying a lot of postage for every one of these bits, because my big antenna wouldn't open. So I'm limited. If I send you twice as many bits, you're only going to get half as many pictures from the whole mission. Right? There's no two ways about it. Now, if I want to make sure every bit gets there, what do I send you? I send you as many bits as I need to, and then I double it. That way, if any bit went wrong, you can compare it and find the error. Right? But that's not good enough, because if I double it, you don't know which of the two pictures was right. So I have to triple it. So I have to send you every picture three times. Yes? That's very expensive. I can only send you one third of the pictures from the entire mission. So here's an alternative that I could do. I could send you a few bits. Now some of them will be zero and some of them will be one. And then I can keep an extra bit position, just one. So after every, let's say after every seven bits, I'll count up the number of zeros and ones. And if the number of zeros if the number of ones I sent you is an even number, I'll put a zero in the eighth bit. Otherwise, if it's an odd number, I'll put a one in the eighth bit. Now that gives me a pretty good chance of detecting any mistakes, because if only one bit out of seven has flipped, this parity bit will be wrong. So if I get eight bits in a row with only one mistake, I can detect it. With me? You see how this works so far, right? We actually do this. Somebody said, why are bytes 8 bits? They don't need to be 8 bits. They only need to be 7 bits, right? 7 bits will... Oh, somebody said, how do you do all that math in your head? With 7 bits, with 1 bit, I can represent 2 possibilities, right? zero, or one. Somebody said, is that zero and one? No, no, zero or one. One bit, like a digit, I can write it down, because it's not a decimal thing, digit, it's a binary thing, a bit. That comes from the same root as digit. Okay, so I have this binary digit, bit, that's a zero or a one, two possibilities. Two bits, how many possibilities? Four. Three bits? Eight. Four bits? 16. Five bits? How many letters in the English language? 26 plus how many digits? 10? 46? 36, more than 32, won't fit in 5 bits. You can't represent English in 5 bits, so we use 6 bits. That was what was called binary coded decimal. Lord only knows why, but it was 6 bits. And then the extended binary coded decimal used 8 bits. That's an exception. But nobody cares because nobody uses that anymore. 6 turned out to be too few. I can represent the printable characters, upper and lower case. Some punctuation, but not enough punctuation. And I can get, but I can't get things like carriage return, line feed, I can't get very many of those in. So I use an extra bit, 7 bit, and that's what I use to record a character. It'll hold 128 possibilities, so there are 128 characters. Right? 64 of them printable, 64 of them control characters. Right. Control codes, really, they're not characters. Okay. And then I add a parity bit. And that would allow my keyboard to communicate something to the computer, and the computer could say, oh, something went wrong between the keyboard and the computer. Now, that almost never happens anymore. It used to happen because of mechanical problems with mechanical keyboards. So people stopped using the parity bit. But that's the idea of parity. With me on this so far? How parity came to be? So that's called the parity bit. And it was called even parity and odd parity, right, the zero or one, whatever it was there. Now that let me detect one error. If I wanted to detect more errors, I could have put more parity bits on. But that gets pretty expensive, and it doesn't correct them. That's okay. If I notice that the character coming in from the keyboard doesn't work well, I could just type it again, and maybe it gets there the second time. But something coming from Saturn, where it takes days for the light to get to you, hours, minutes, anyway, it takes a long time. I don't want to hold the picture and send the signal back to Saturn and says, okay, I got that one, send me the next one. I just want to send them all down. But I want to send you enough information, not just to detect an error, but to correct it. So, this is a standard engineer's trick now. I've taken a real problem in the world, and I've reduced it to the single problem of finding out if there's an error in these 7 bits. Right? If I could do that, then I could do every 7 bits, right? So now I don't have to think about the big, complicated problem anymore. I think about the problem of I got 7 bits, and I want to make sure they got 3. So I put a parity bit on. And then you can check it, but you can't correct it, because you don't know which one was wrong. With me so far? So now I'm going to abstract the problem further. Let's say that instead of sending you 7 bits, and a parity bit, I send you all 8 bits and as much information as I need to correct any one of those 8 bits. Okay? So just stop thinking 7 for a moment. It's not that I'm sending you 7 plus 1 plus more. Now I'm sending you an 8-bit signal. This is just the way the slides were originally done last time. So I'm sending you 8 bits, and I want to send you those 8 bits plus however much information you need to correct one bit that's in error. With me? From Saturn. Okay. How many possibilities with 8 bits? 256. Right? Okay. Now, how many different bits could be wrong? If there's only one error, it's one of those 8 bits, right? Okay. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to send you more than 8 bits. Let's say that I send you 13 bits. 8 plus 5 is in my head. Okay. I send you 13 bits. Now, any one of the 13 could be wrong. The bits that are checking for errors can have errors, right? So I send you 13 bits. How many things kind of represent the 13 bits? Five, 10, 24. 20, 48, 40, 96. Then you have 4,096 possibilities. Yeah? That's 2 to the 5th more than I could have done with just 8 bits. 32 times as many possibilities. So now what I'm doing is I'm taking a space of 4,096 possibilities, and I'm going to take the 256 valid possibilities and I'm going to scatter them around the number line. See how this is the number line? The number line that goes from 0 to 4,095 has all the integers on it. 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, up to 4,095. That's what I could represent. I'm going to take the 256 valid codes and scatter them around the number line. It's not very densely packed anymore, right? There are only a few valid codes, only 256 out of 4,096. You see this in your head? Everybody? Yes? No. Yes? Yes. Okay. Now, I'm going to scatter them such that every time I get an error in the lowest bit, it simply moves to the next number, right? If it was supposed to be a 1 and it became a 0, it just moves 1 in the number line. See that? Let's say that I have a number, 8-bit number. There's an 8-bit number. Can you guys see this all the way over there? Okay. There's an 8-bit number. I'll just underline the 2 nibbles just so they're easier to see. I should never say nibbles, but what the heck? Okay, now, what happens if this bit changes to a 1? Well, this number here is 0, 1, 2. Right? Mm-hmm. I'm counting. Mm-hmm. Counting binary 0, then 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 2, 3. Decimal? Repeat? Okay, you don't have to reproduce this. You just have to stop asking what great thought is. Okay, so if this changes, this number here was originally 2, and it could become a 3. 3 would be wrong. 2 was the correct number. That make sense? I mean, it can only change into a 1. It can't change into anything else. Yeah? Now, it might not be that one that changed. It might have been this one that changed. You can't change 2 things at the same time and still recover using RAID 5. So, I make the assumption there's only 1 failure. Okay? So maybe it's this one. Well, what was the number originally? It was 2. What can it become? 0. Okay, good. Now, what if it was this one that changed? So then it becomes, this is the 4's place, this is the 2's place, this is the 1's place. Remember all that stuff you had to learn in base 8? Mm-hmm. Anyway, this is base 2. 1's place, 2's place, 4's place, so it'd be 4 plus 2 is 6. So 2 can become 6. 2 can become, now look, it doesn't really matter, we could do this all day. If there are only 8 of them, it can only become 8 different numbers, right? You see that? Okay. Now, if there are 13 of them, it can become 13 different numbers. Yes? Okay. Now what I did, when I took these 8 and I added another 5, parity, I get to set those any way I want. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to recode these numbers so that I only use up 256 of the positions, and I'm going to leave all the nearby positions empty. Every position you can get by changing this bit from a valid code, I'll leave it empty. Everything you can get to by changing this bit, I'll leave it empty. It won't be a valid code. Right? Not only that, it won't be one away from some other valid code. You can't get You can't get to the same code with a single bit error from two different valid codes. I'm losing you. Do you see what I've done? I've got a lot of possibilities and I'm only using a few of them. I'm going to scatter things out in such a way that I can't possibly have two valid codes that get mapped to the same error code. So I'm going to say, here's a valid code, somewhere over there's a valid code, and any single error from this code creates an invalid code. And any second error doesn't create a valid code again. So now there's no two valid codes that could have created this invalid code you're receiving. Now I can reverse that. The trick to do that is to add enough of these bits to increase the size of this by at least the number of bits in the total. So I must have, in my parity, at least the ability to represent 8 different possibilities, otherwise I won't have enough valid codes. Plus a factor of 2, okay, so I need 16 possibilities so that I don't have 2 that goes to the same place. Plus I have to allow for 1 extra possibility. So I need to delete these just to have the code space large enough. That to avoid ambiguity. And this to avoid the problem you'll notice here that 2 can go to 0, but just as easily 4 could have gone to 0. So I can't use any code that's 1 bit away from 0 because I can't tell them apart. So I have to scatter these things out far enough to code them. It turns out that if I add 5 of these to these 8, that's enough. Now, you should be looking at this point and saying, fuck. I'm not sure I could design it, but if you build it, I'll fly to Saturn for you and take pictures. Yeah? I believe I can get my picture there. You can believe that. What does this have to do with this? Well, disks are communication with the future, right? I put my bits in, and then in the future somebody else will take them out. So storage is communication, but it's communication through time. Okay? So, I'm going to have a single bit error here. Well, we can do this lining up as many bits stacked on top of these as we want. We repeat this as many times as we want. So each one of these doesn't have to be a bit. Each one of these could be a whole stack of bits. Every set of 8 has its own parity. So I have to buy that many disk drives. 13 disk drives. And what do I get? Something you would only dream of next time your hard drive crashes. I have 13 hard drives. How often do they fail? 13 times as often as 1, right? That's the problem with twin-engine airplanes. They have twice as many engine failures. Right? Do that kind of thing. They really do. You have 13 disk drives, you get 13 times as many disk failures. But when one fails, that's a bit failure. There. I pull that disk drive out, pop another disk drive in, hopefully one that works, and I can reconstruct what should be on it from the missing ones. They're just bad bits. So I reconstruct the bad bits, and if I get that done before the next disk drive fails, I'm up and running. I'm completely reconstructed. And I didn't have to buy twice as many disks. In fact, I couldn't have completely reconstructed it without 3 times as many disks. Okay? Do you see the idea here? This is called hot swap disks. I don't even have to shut the thing down. I reach in, pull the disk out, pop it over the disk in, push the reloaded button. It figures out what should be on that disk and writes it back. Yes? This idea is built into the CPU. There's a lot of memory. It's doing a lot of reading and writing to memory. It makes mistakes. So parity is used inside the CPU. It's used on buses. But it never becomes visible to you. I never would have mentioned it in class, except for this idea that you can swap bad disks on the fly. But if you don't swap, that bad disc before the second one fails, you can't recover. Yep. So this is one fault-tolerant RAID, which is what RAID 5 provides. You can also get two fault-tolerant RAID by buying even more disks. It'll tolerate two faults. If you're the Social Security Administration, and you're keeping the Social Security records of the United States on your disk array, you have a bunch of people who are sitting here doing probabilistic failure analysis, trying to figure out what's the probability you're going to lose everything from one disk failure, from RAID 5 that's one fault tolerant, from an approach that's two fault tolerant, and you buy then large collections of disks, and you have standby disks sitting there running already, and you don't even pull it out and put another one in, you just flip a switch. Right? So you can get any level of protection you want. But the point is, you pick up that redundancy without having to duplicate. You don't have to double. You have to do something again. Something over. And, this is important, you can't do this with a pair of disk drives or three disk drives. There's a cost of entry to get into this. And to get it to be efficient, you need to be up around 13 disk drives. Otherwise, you don't get much space. You got a little bit. Make sense? No? Okay. Next question. Y'all did the homework. Just fun? Answered every question you had last week? Yeah.
Does access time depend on how large the information is, or the book says item?
Yep. Good. Okay, so magnetic disk. You could think about how to do this with a DVD, but think about a magnetic disk. A magnetic disk is a set of tracks, eccentric tracks, and I have to get the head, the read head, over the right track. How long does that take? Well, it kind of depends, because maybe it's already there. Then it's just reading from that track. Or maybe it's a long way away. On average, I'm a third of the way into the disk, and I have to go two-thirds of the way into the disk. All right, so that's, if you work out the average, it says. So on average, I have to traverse a third of the disk every time you ask me to move that head. Then how long do I have to wait? Well, my good luck. Here comes the sector I want, rotates under the read head. My bad luck, it just passed. On average, how long do I have to wait? Half the time around, right? Okay, now how long do I have to read it for? Well, if there's a lot of stuff, I gotta read for a long time. There's a little bit of stuff, I read for a short time. But on the disk, it's broken up into what are called sectors, so I always have to read at least one sector. And it turns out that if I try to read two sectors in a row, about the time I get set up to read the second sector, it's just passed. I'd have to wait all the way around. So sectors are normally interspersed. So I'll write the first sector, the third sector, the fifth sector, the seventh sector. It's not the fastest way to do it, but that works pretty well on a desktop system. So there are optimized versions for systems that are doing disk-intensive processing, like Google. Okay? Okay. So, how many sectors I have to read? Sure. But once I read the first sector, I may not have to wait very long to get to the second sector. Okay. So, the main cost in the whole thing is moving the head. That's the slowest thing. Because when the head starts moving, it's not moving yet, so I got to push it. And when I want to stop it, I got to brake it. And so if you think about this in your car, you know, accelerate, get going, move, get to where you're going, stop. And now just think I'm going to do this for 10 years. So I don't really want to hit this thing too hard every time. Yeah. So I move it relatively slowly to get reliability. Make sense? Answer your question? Good. Yes, ma'am.
Question about DSL versus cable.
Oh, good.
And this may be a very obvious answer, but the book says that the main difference in terms of the amount of time it's going to take to download something, whatever, is going to be the cable you're sharing with like the entire neighborhood, whereas the DSL is your one line.
Yeah.
So it'd be faster generally than any one line.
Yeah. You're right, but no.
Okay. Well, that's what I was wondering. I have DSL.
Yeah.
And there's certain times of day when it's a lot slower
yeah.
than other times. So I was wondering if that is because of what's on the other end.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like I'd access in place, so a lot of those people are accessing mm-hmm. at that time. Okay.
Yep, good. So that's the subject of today's class. Does anybody have questions for Rebecca? No. Okay, so there'll be a drop-by and a wave most evenings, but it's literally a drop-by and a wave. Get her now or get her never.
Right. If you have any questions, you can have questions on Saturday.
Thank you. Let me build that into the class. Because the answer is yes. Other questions?
Yeah, you pulled your cell phone out last week and said that you used it as a notice. But from our reading, it said that the transfer rates for the bandwidth for a cell phone, it's not very much. Well, I think for a 3G, it said it might have been like 3 megabytes per second.
Yes.
Do you use like 3 megabytes per second, or is there a different way to have it go faster?
So I get 115 kilobytes per second out of my cell phone. Which is twice as fast as the older GPRS version. This is EDGE, they call it EDGE, where the G is one of those horrible recursive acronyms. A GPRS stands for something, and EDGE stands for something, and the G is GPRS, which stands for something. So I get 115 kilobits per second. Now, notice what I said. I didn't say 115 kilobytes per second. So you have to divide that by 8 to figure out how many bytes I'm getting through this thing. And because of the way modems work, modems have like really good advertising, you have to divide actually by 10. So I'm getting 11.5 kilo characters per second through this thing, which is faster than I can type. But it's slower than web pages go on. So when I'm browsing web pages, it's really bad. I tried once watching the NewsHour, with Jim Lehrer on this streaming video. It works for about 5 minutes and then I kind of figure that it's done more than its fair share. It's really lousy video quality. So it's just, it's low bandwidth. On the other hand, it works in Croatia. I mean, it works everywhere. It's also very expensive. It's $15 a megabyte. And if you work out the homework, you'll know that a megabyte isn't very much. It used to seem like a lot. It wasn't just that. Okay, now you're going to learn a secret about me this semester, which is not really a secret, so I'm going to tell you right now, is that I'm terrible at minutes. Absolutely terrible at minutes. And you have to help me. Now, here's how you can help me. My student thought this was hilarious. Just tell me your email address, and I'll get that. But there are some people whose names I don't. Well, listen.
Your end of that question segued into my question. It always baffles me. How come you can access the internet on your, like iPhone or BlackBerry or whatever, virtually anywhere you go. But I can't on my computer unless someone's got a wireless internet connection I can get on or an Ethernet cable. Why? I don't understand that.
Okay, give me a second to get this in the right place and then I will reveal all. It would have been, if you'd asked the question a few years ago, you would have asked it the other way. Why is it when I go to Starbucks I can use the internet? But now you ask the question, why is it when I'm not in Starbucks I can't use the internet? Right? As if the internet is supposed to be in the air or something, right? I mean,
But it is on your cell phone. I mean, on your whatever.
Yes. So this is connected to the internet now, which means it will probably ring. And
my computer is connected to the internet now if I turn it on, because the campus has a wireless network. But they run on different frequencies. They use different kinds of radios. So there's a little radio in here, a little radio in my computer, and they're different. And so I pay to use this one, and it seems to me like I don't pay to use the other one, but you've already figured out you pay for me to use the other one. The tuition and fees and stuff like that go for is the network. And so they just put different radio infrastructure around. In fact, in this room, let me see if you can see it. The antennas for the wireless that the computers use, I don't see one, hang down, and they're round, and they're about this long, right? They look like sort of a very small Luke Skywalker lightsabers, right? They're, but yeah, very small fluorescent light sort of things, right? And you'll see them probably out in the hallways or something. So those are for one. This uses the exact same signal as the cell phone. In fact, this is a digital cell phone. It's digitizing my voice and sending the digital signal. And it simply uses the same transmitter and sends it to a cell phone tower. So when you drive by a University Boulevard and your cell phone call drops, many people have that happen to them, yeah? Mm-hmm. That's because there are no cell phone towers near University Boulevard. But when you're in this building and you've got lousy cell phone reception, because it's a, you know, it's got lots of metal in the walls, you get perfectly fine wireless LAN, we call it, WLAN or Wi-Fi, because there are a lot of very small little local transmitters. So fees you pay to wire this building, but you could go into another building on campus and not have that there. For the longest time, the president's office didn't have it, but the classrooms did.
I mean, I get that, but I guess I don't understand. If you want to pay for it, why you can't just take the computer outside, like your cell phone, and log on to the internet anywhere you are?
You can. You can buy a card that goes into your cell phone.
But I know, into your computer, laptop.
I'm sorry, into your laptop, yeah.
Well, but I know that they don't necessarily work everywhere that a cell phone works. So that's why.
But there are 10 different kinds of cell phones. Not all of them are digital. And it only works over the digital networks.
So, okay. So your computer could be that way if you put that.
If you put that into the computer, there's not a market for computers with that in it because you have to pay for each cell phone company. But there is a market for the wireless LANs because Starbucks put them in. I mean, that's really what happened. You know, nobody would put a modem in for a network that didn't exist because you couldn't connect it to anything, right? This was the problem with the telephone company in the early days. Nobody would, why would I pay to get a telephone? If nobody else had one, who would I call? So all of these things have problems that you have to build the infrastructure. You have to build it out at the same time. And so you end up spending a fortune on the infrastructure before you sell the first cell phone or before you sell the first modem. But once you do, you sell these at a tremendous clip, which means you have to have some way of spending money without making money. But that's a different course. That's the business. Make sense? Okay. Shall we get started? So I skipped half the glass lesson. What we talked about was hardware. But you know, the hardware really isn't the interesting thing. The interesting thing is the software. Because the hardware is pretty much all the same. I can make my CPU a little bit different, or I can make my memory a little bit faster. But you learn that stuff in a week, and you pretty much got the idea. I'm not going to come back and tell you about new spiffy hardware. Maybe a new spiffy cell phone. But otherwise, the hardware is pretty much the same. What keeps changing is the software. And this is a tremendous accomplishment. The first generation of industry, things were done, before we call industry, things were done with human power, right? The second generation, what we call the Industrial Revolution, things were done with machine power. But machines were programmed to do one thing. So if I got a machine that could grind meat, that machine couldn't pump water, right? The machine was designed to do what it was designed to do. Then in the third generation, we got programmable machines. The first of these are actually programmable, like pianos and programmable sewing machines, looms and things like this. But ultimately what we got was programmable information processing machines.
So it's the program that changes. So now if I ask you, in a computer, in, for example, this computer, which is more expensive, the hardware or the software?
Generally software.
The software. Now, that's a mass, I mean, the software, I just copied it, right? The hardware, I actually have to, like, press the die and stuff like that, right? And still, the software is more expensive, even though I can just copy it. Now, if you want some custom software, if you want to hire a program to program something, that will cost you like 100 times what the machine costs that you rented on. So what's happened is we've taken all of the general purpose functions and stuffed them in a reprogrammable machine, thus moving all the costs to software. Now, that's an improvement over what we had before, where we had to design a completely new machine every time we wanted to do something. But what it means is, if you know how to create software, you are the high priest of information processing. Because that's the top of the heap, right? Is the ability to cause the machine to do what you want. Now, a lot of people actually heard that message and then went to study computer science. But that's because they didn't hear the whole message. If you know how to create the software that does what needs to be done, right? Then you're the high priest. So the real question is, what needs to be done? And that's not fundamentally a question about the machine. That's a question about how we organize our society and what role people play in it. And that's constantly changing. So that's more where we plug in. Although we do offer courses in how to program the machine, and we do have a homework time, something like that, in how to program the machine. So you'll at least get a little flavor of what the folks are doing, one level down on the ladder. Okay, so there are several ways of slicing this, but here is one. The things you know about, we would call application programs. If you can click on it and start the program, then it's the program you're interacting with, we think that's the application program. A level down from that is the operating system. Now what the operating system does, you know, you have something where you say, oh, it's on C. Let me know what I mean when I say it's on C. It's the hard drive, right? How did the hard drive become C? Why isn't it like R or something? Because some programmer decided that A would be the floppy, B would be the second floppy, because back then we needed two floppy disks. C would be the hard drive, because not everybody had a hard drive. Right? Well, now not everybody has a floppy, but the thing's still C. So the thing that knows that it's C is the operating system. That's actually a program. Right? So somebody wrote that program. Now, you don't go reprogramming the operating system very often. If you do, you're several levels down in the second order. But when you want to go change the operating system, remember the old computers, you see them on like Lost in Space, they got lights that light up and they got switches, right? So what happens when you wanted to program the computer, what you did was you had all those ones and zeros you wanted to be a certain way inside the computer, so up would be one and down would be zero, and you just go set all the switches and push the button that said load, and then set up, load, set up, load, and you just do that until memory was full. I think it was the hard drive. On the homework? 80 gigabytes. Okay, so how many times did you have to do that?
80 billion times.
Okay, so that was like a weak bad idea. That was okay in the early days when they had like 50 bytes or something, right? But not so good when you have 80 gigabytes. Okay, so what do you have to do? Well, you have to have some way to set all that stuff. So what you want to do is you want to write something that looks like what one person would say to another. Maybe a little more scripted and formalized, but something like what one person would say to another. Give it to the computer, have the computer interpret it, change it into the ones and zeros that are appropriate, and store it in the right places. How do you do that? Oh, this is just lovely. You get a programmer to write a program that interprets the program and writes out the program. Do that again. You get a programmer to write a program that interprets the program and writes out the program. So we have the uncompiled program. We're going to compile the program using something called a compiler.
Or, if we do this at runtime, we have the uninterpreted program. We're going to have a program called an interpreter that reads the instruction and figures out the ones and zeros just in time. So, these are called compilers and interpreters. Now you're thinking, I'm not doing compilers and interpreters. I'm not even doing operating systems. I will run the application program. But JavaScript, how many people have heard of JavaScript? Which makes your web pages do things that would be hard to do otherwise, like check entries for validity. That's a programming language. It's interpreted by an interpreter, and that produces then the ones and zeros that tell the computer what to do. So that's what we'll do the homework on. You'll actually modify a JavaScript program. So you get to play with this. You certainly play with these a lot. You buy computers that contain these, and then the embedded program, well, something must load the operating system when you turn the thing on. So I told you last time about the basic input-output system, the BIOS, in ROM, in the read-only memory. That's an embedded program. It's not a program you ever run. When you flip a switch, that program runs automatically. There's an embedded program in my watch. And what it does is every second it says, okay, add a second, show them the time, add a second, show them the time, add a second, show them the time. There's a little computer in here, it's running the program, that's what it does. Right? So that's an application program, but not one you think about. Sorry. But I call it embedded. It's an embedded software in your microphone. Okay? So, we'll spend an awful lot of the semester talking about this, which is why it got de-emphasized here at the beginning. Because we'll go into all sorts of ways of using software. Now, when you install a new application, it might come on a CD or DVD, or it might just come as a file. And what you do is you open the file. Some of them come as .exe, which means it can be executed directly. So you execute it, and it has a program that you run when you execute it that doesn't really do anything except take all the files out of a stuffed package of files and stick them in the right place on your hard drive so that later when you run them, everything will work. That's all that's going on when you install software. So it runs a program that puts everything in the right place. One of the things it puts in the right place is called a dynamic link library. So it's a kind of a thing. It's a file that ends in DLL. It's actually normally written lowercase, but L's look like ones in lowercase, so one of the things you learn about when you work with computers is to write uppercase a lot when you want to be clear. Right? There's less potential for confusion. Ones and zeros are still confusing, and so in the United States, we put a slash through our zeros. If you want to be really clear, it's a zero, not an O. Right? But in Europe, they put a slash through their O's. So that doesn't work a lot. Ones and zeros and O's are still a problem. These DLL files are shared, and if you uninstall a program, sometimes it will uninstall the DLL file that something else was using. But it's just, otherwise they're just files that have common capabilities like reading or writing from the screen, reading or writing from the keyboard. Then you have to find a way to associate the name of the program with, for example, what directory should it refer to when it opens? So you have to give some features to it. And that's put in the registry on Windows. And so that's what an installer does. It pulls the pieces out, puts them in the right place on your hard drive, and then loads the registry with information that's needed so that when it runs, it has the right context to run. Okay? Now, some of the things in this class are deep conceptual, and some of the things in the class are you got to know to do the homework next week. And so this is closer to the second, although there's no homework on this, you will undoubtedly go pulling down software and installing it, and wishing that you hadn't, and trying to figure out how to uninstall it, and wondering what happened to the DLL that's about missing. Okay. But the class is really about networking. Now, people talk about networking. They talk about going to parties, meeting people who work in the same business, exchanging business cards, that kind of thing. This is when computers go to parties. other computers, exchange routing tables. So, well, the things we talked about last week were fascinating for about 3 years. You could really, for 3 years, you could think about all the things that were on your computer. You could run out of things to think about that were on your computer. You have to buy more things and put them on your computer. So you can keep, your computer can keep you entertained for a few years. You can put games on it and stuff like that. But after a while, it's just by itself, right? There's nothing that it communicates with. So if you were in the business of doing mathematical computations, you could entertain yourself with a computer for your whole life. But if you want to exchange information, you need other computers. And the computers are the important thing here. The important thing is the information. So today, we're going to do the plumbing. How do we get the information back and forth? Without spending too much time thinking about what is it we're connecting. And then we'll spend the rest of the semester having this plumbing done. So the first thing we needed was we needed the terminal. We needed the thing that connects to the network. And we didn't actually really care too much about computing with it. We just wanted to know how to type stuff in and get stuff on the screen and what happens when I move my mouse. Right? So that we can connect it to the network. Now we're going to connect it to the network, and then we're going to find out how to get information around the network. Then we can think later about what to do once we have that. So here's the fundamental problem. I've got some ones and zeros, and I want to send them to you. And I'm in South Africa. And you're not. Okay? Now, how would I get information? Forget about computing. Think about the post office. How would I get information from South Africa to you? Let's say I had your name, your address. Okay. How do I get stuff to you? I write your address on the envelope, and I give it to the post office. Okay. That doesn't really solve the problem, right? I just got it to the post office. The post office now has to get it to you. How does the post office get it to you? How does the post office get you my package?
They could send it by air, they could send it by land, they could
send it by sea. So I'm in South Africa, right? I have no trucks going to Elizabeth's house.
Okay.
What's that?
And I'm saying,
okay.
They send it to a distribution site, and then they send it.
Where's the distribution site?
Well, where
in South Africa. Some bigger place in South Africa?
No, probably here. And then
how do they get it to here?
They truck it.
They truck it to here from South Africa.
No. It's a distribution site here. Let's say, or fly it.
They fly it. Okay. So first I have to get it to an airport, right? I can't fly it from the post office. Okay. So in South Africa, I have to get it to an airport, right? Okay, how many airports are there in South Africa?
Bunch.
Yeah. Which one?
Whichever
one's closest to where my package is? Closest international airport to where my package is? Okay, so I got a list of international airports. And now, if my package is going to Washington, do I send it to the same airport as if it's going to Cleveland? Really, if I'm in South Africa?
Oh, yeah.
Probably. Yeah? Okay. But what if it's going to... What's that?
I thought it was
from
South Africa.
Oh, no, it's from South Africa. So what if it's going to Zimbabwe?
Then I might put it on a truck.
Or I might send it to an airport. Same airport? Maybe not. Maybe not. Okay, so for each location that I might send a package to, I'm going to have a list of which way of getting this thing out of my post office I should take, right? Yes? I mean, pick up a package and it's going to, I don't know, you think about it in this country. Like for this zip code, put it in the truck. For this zip code, send it to that airport. For this zip code, pick up the FedEx package and don't tell anybody. Yes? Okay. So I must have a routing table. A table that tells me for every destination how to route it. Okay. How many zip codes are there?
Not. Yeah. Okay. Good. So if I'm in South Africa, do you think my routing table was organized by zip code in the United States? No. Because for every zip code, what would it say? Send it to the airport. Right? So it simply says United States Airport. And then at the airport, it says United States. Ooh, how many airplanes go to the United States from South Africa?
Per
day?
Not too many.
One. And what if I have a lot of packages? They won't all fit on the airplane. So how would I get it here if the airplane is full?
Send it first to England and then send it to
here. Okay, good. So I got lots of flights to England from South Africa, and I think the folks in England have flights to Washington. Now, it might be that they don't. My information might be outdated. There could have been a terrorist threat, and they've shut down the airport. But so it's a good guess, right? So I have, my routing table has a primary, put it on the plane to Dulles, and an alternate, put it on the plane to London, and maybe several alternates. And if the Q, anybody here British? Q, U, E? A line? If the queue of packages is too long, then I put it on an alternate route. Yes? So I must have an estimate of how long it will take to get there by one route, and how long it will take to get there by the alternate route. And how do I make an estimate of how long it will take to get there from London? What's that?
Whatever their routing table can assess.
And how will I get it from them? If I'm a post office, they will mail me their routing table, right? Because we got this mail thing going, right? So if I'm a computer network, they'll just send you their routing table. Yes? Okay, great. Now you know how that works. Skip all this. Okay. So, well, I'll start one step back. When I write an address, do I put the most specific part of the address first, or the most general part of the address?
The general.
I'm right. What's that? The most specific, and I end with the most general, right? When I do a phone number, do I put the most specific or the most general? The most general, right? The most specific last, right? Most general last. Phone numbers are most general first. Which one's right? Whichever one. Right. Good. So, learning from this, when we designed the internet, we did it both ways. Okay. So, in the internet, the most general is first, and the most specific is last, in what's called an internet protocol address, the IP address. Every computer on the network, which is to say, every computer that is directly connected to the network, so I could connect a computer to another computer and connect that computer to the network. This wouldn't be true in that case, but for every computer that is directly connected to the network, it has an IP address. The last number is the address of the computer, and then this is the address of the network that that computer can be found on. So this is sort of like your street address, your city, your state, and your country. They don't work that way, but it's, you can think of them that way. Now, this is just a writing convention. These are really just ones and zeros. So, I'll show you how to convert it. Zero is 000. 5 is 110. Is that right? No, 101. Okay? 1 is 001. So there is a mapping from these way of writing, where you'll notice none of these numbers.
Did I get that right?
I think I just lied. I just lied. Sorry. Let me start over. This is, don't interpret them separately, this is 150 out of 256. So there are 8 bits here, 8 bits here, 8 bits there, 8 bits there, and they run from 0 to 255. Right? So sometimes you see these written the largest possible number, 255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.255.
32-bit binary number. Now, how many computers can we connect to the internet? Or less than none?
Many.
Two to the 32nd. That's the number of addresses there are. How many computers will ever be built? It turns out it's larger than 2 to the 32nd. So then you have to get a whole new internet protocol that has longer addresses, which they call IPv6. Okay, so it's IPv4, the old one. So when I say that this identifies a specific computer, there's nothing magic about that dot. I just have a set of 32 bits. And some set of them tells me which network, some prefix set, and some suffix set tells me which computer. The University of Maryland, which has a lot of computers, has a short prefix and a long suffix. Comcast has a short prefix and a long suffix. Joe's Ethernet service has a long prefix and a short suffix. But still, no matter how we do it, we're going to run out. Okay, so that's the first thing. Now, if I have that, if everybody's computer has got a number, then I just make tables where I say, if you want to route it to 216.141.anything, you route it to 120.0.0.0. So just imagine this is you here, and you can route it to 120.0.0.0 or to 121.0.0.0. Now what this means is, you went out and you bought this phone line, and you pay for it 24 hours a day. And you bought that phone line, and you pay for it 24 hours a day. And now you can send packets in either direction, and anybody in the world you're going to reach, you're going to get to by going to one or the other of those first. Okay? That's how the internet really does, a bunch of point-to-point networks. So, if I send it to 216.141, anything I go to the left, otherwise, for 216 anything, I go to the right. So you see how to read this? If I want to send it to 216.142, which way do I send it? 216.142.2.1. I send it to the right, to 121.0.0.0, because it doesn't match this. So I just start at the top. Remember I told you computers are stupid? So this is perfect for them, right? Look at the first one. Does it match? No. Look at the second one. Does it match? Yes. Fine, do it. So do you see how we implement alternatives? Now, the estimated delay to get to 216.141.anywhere is 18 milliseconds. Estimated delay to get to here is 34 milliseconds. How do I know? Well, I just asked 121.0.0.0, what's your estimated delay to get to 216.anywhere in your routing table? And it told me, just by sending me a routing table. And then I said, well, how long does it take me to get a packet to there? Do you know how to find out how long it takes to get a packet there? What does that mean?
You send it back to yourself.
I send myself a packet through there. Right, I just send the packet to here, saying, addressing it to me. I just see how long it takes to come back. Divide by two. That's an estimate, because it might have been slow to turn it around and send it back. So I do it every once in a while, and I get a pretty good idea. Make sense? This is an automatically configuring post office. And there's no geography. all those things that we thought were cities and states and countries and all that stuff, very simply,
this much of the prefix, that much of the prefix, that much of the prefix. See how this works?
We got a show of hands on yes and no. How about yes? No. Ask a question if you're in the no group.
I don't even know where to begin because I'm thoroughly lost.
Somebody else.
I'll find a book back to that. Somebody else asked me a question from the no group. Who else is in the no group? Ask me a question.
You asked earlier which way something would move if
it
was
sent
to the right. And
that was where it went up.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Front of the clock. So you've got 120.0.0.0 on the left and the right.
No, that's 121.0.0.
121, sorry. Why?
Okay. Okay, so the answer to your question is that if I'm here and I'm told to go to 121, I refer to that informally as to the right, because I wrote it on the right. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. But that didn't help the I'm completely lost. Did you understand how I can get a package to Washington different from Zimbabwe?
Yes.
Okay. So it's pretty clear that if I'm in this classroom and I want to send a package to Cleveland, I might send it in a different direction than if it was going to Singapore.
Yes.
So I'd have to know which way to send it.
Yes.
And I couldn't really ask everybody along the way, so I just keep a list that says if you're going to Singapore, then send it this way, and if you're going to Cleveland, send it that way.
Right.
But now I have to make that list.
Right.
Okay, so how am I going to make the list? Now I don't have geography to help me anymore. I can't sit around saying, oh, Washington's a long way away. I should use an airplane for that. I'll need an airport, because lots of things are directly connected. For example, there are people in Northern Virginia that have telephone lines that go straight to Tokyo. So Northern Virginia is right next to Tokyo in cyberspace, right? The next, you know, if you get on this line, the place you get off is Tokyo. Just like the airport in South Africa is right next to Washington. You get on the airplane, the only place you get off is Washington. Every package gets on here goes to Washington. Even if you wanted to then go back from Washington to Europe, right? You can't get off on the way. So I have to make my routing table based on information from my neighbors about what they can reach. Does that part make sense?
Yeah, that part.
Then I have to write it down somehow. So what I write down normally is, if I'm in Zimbabwe, if I want to go to Zimbabwe, go this way. If I want to go to the United States, go that way. So I have this sort of way of genericizing all the places in the United States as United States by starting with the most general part of the address. So that's what I do here. The most general part of the address is on the left in the case of computer addresses. So I start here and I say, everything's going to here, send it that way. Everything's going to here, some other place, send it the same way. Everything going anywhere that I haven't told you about before, send it to 121. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can say if it's going to 216.141.anything, send it to 120. If it's not going there, but it's going to 216 dot somewhere, send it to 121. Make sense?
Yes.
And the way that I find out how long it takes to get there is I ask them, how long would it take you people at the next stop, to get it to this destination? They tell me, and I add a little bit of time for how long it takes me to get to them. Still with me?
Yes.
How long does it take for me to get to them? I don't know, but I'll just send them something and ask them to send it back and see how long it takes. And I'll divide by two. Good?
Mm-hmm.
So this is just for like a randomly
generated thing that you just kind of wrote down.
Oh, yeah, I just made this up.
That's the part that was.
Okay.
I was trying to sort of make a pattern as to why.
Okay. Okay, so here's a story before the break. Northern Virginia turns out to be the center of the internet. Now, the internet doesn't really have a center because it's a whole bunch of things going through a whole bunch of things, but an awful lot of the internet goes through Northern Virginia. And what that means is that there are a lot of people in Northern Virginia that have bought leased lines to other places in the world, which makes Northern Virginia a hub in this network. And then there are a lot of companies in Northern Virginia that move traffic around among themselves, and then out it goes to where it is. One of those companies had a little problem with one of their computers. And the only thing it affected was the routing table. What happened was this entry that says to reach anywhere on the internet inadvertently got written first instead of last. And this entry that said how long it takes to get there inadvertently got written with zeros. Now, the way in which this is indicated as I'll send it anywhere is you just put all zeros. And then zeros for this. So what that said was, so imagine this in the number one position. It said, I can get your packet, your piece of information, anywhere on the planet instantly. Yes? Now, I then send my routing table to everybody and I say, I can get packets anywhere, instantly. So, no matter how long it takes for them to get packets to me, it's still a good way to get packets to any place to just get them to me because I can get them anywhere instantly. Yes? So then what happens? Shortly thereafter, everybody sends all the traffic on the entire internet to my one computer. Which then says, I think it's lunchtime, and goes out to lunch, and fails. Holding, as it fails, the entire traffic of the internet. It shut down the internet for 4 hours. By putting, I can send something anywhere, instantly. Thus attracting everything, not being able to do it, sort of ducked and ran, which is, of course, what you would do. Okay. So, they then programmed it so that if somebody said they could get anything anywhere instantly, nobody would believe them. So how did they learn to do that?
They had,
yeah, from experience. Right. Okay. Shall we take a 10-minute break?
I have a prefix up there, but is the prefix just the first three sets and then the suffix with the
last? Yes, any part you want.
So what's the suffix?
All the rest.
The rest of
the remaining part, the part I've indicated with S. Ask that again when we start.
Okay.
People are giving me this, you tell me one more thing, my brain's going to explode. Oh gosh, this is about 4 years ago. Especially during the 690 class. I mean, it wasn't during class, it was during the week, you know. So, I mean, we didn't. Somebody sent me a note that said, you know, somebody cut a cable and, you know, the Middle East is where I bought the internet. I'm like, this is actually better. This is like the way the internet works, fatal. The whole idea was what? Remember the study results I was telling you about? The longer you sit during break, the more likely you are to fall asleep before the next session ends. You stand up. You don't even have to go outside.
That he used in the frame of the prefix. I mean, at least that's not no matter how you do it, right?
I mean,
that would be the four, if it has to identify the computer.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think
it would
be all four of them.
That's really nice.
Yeah, that'd be the
whole answer. Right. And then, you know, I have another question for the knowledge of this, but I thought in both of their shape often that your IP address is really identifying to the computer. It's the modem that you might be connected to. So if I have a wireless router in my house, it's really the IP address of that router, and everybody in my house, let's say, who was connecting to that router, but it doesn't have the same IP, so that would be my IP address.
Questions so far?
My question.
Yes. Which was? Okay, so I'm using the term suffix, prefix to mean the first part of and suffix to mean the last part of in a somewhat standard way. It's just there's no middle part of it.
So the first, so you can have a prefix that one set of three digits, and then the other three sets of digits
to
be a suffix, or it
could
be two sets of the prefix, and the other two
are
suffix.
Yeah, so this is what I'm trying to get you to think about. So, an IP address is 32 bits.
Uh-huh.
Dot. So if I draw, if I have the IP address 255.255.255.0, that really means, that's just a shorthand way of writing, right? It's nothing but a way of writing this. With me on that? 255 is 81. Oh, zero, all zeros is zero. All zeros, one at the end is one. Keep going, it's 255. Okay, so 255.255.255.0, that's just another way of writing this. This is not the IP address. This is the IP address. The IP address is 32 bits. Every letter has an address on it, right? Every real letter, post office, has an address. Every packet that I send through the network has an IP address on it. However long it is, I have 32 bits that tells it where to go. Yes?
Yeah. Oh, all right, yeah.
Okay, good. So, now I want to say prefix or suffix, and you're saying, well, it could be like, that's the prefix and that's the suffix, and I'm like, sure. You're saying, could be, that's the prefix and that's the suffix? Sure. Could also be,
that's the prefix and that's the suffix? Okay.
Okay.
I split it in the middle of one of these ways of writing, but this is just a way of writing. It's the ones and zeros. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, but I mean, how would you know that from the picture you have here where it says the first three, the way you say the first three sets of three digits identifies the land, and then the other one specifies the computer, but it's really not necessarily
ain't
that way.
Right.
Okay.
So, that's one way it might be. Okay? Very good. I have got a request to start over for the break. And do the slides in order. Actually, I did, but I thought, having jumped in the middle, let's go back and fill in the gaps. So, networks are simply a set of computers or other devices, which we'll think of as computers, that are connected to each other by communication devices. So the LAN card, the cell phone card, the wireless LAN card in a computer. That's the communication device. And then that's connected through a transmission medium to another communication device, which is connected to a computer. And that communication line can send ones and zeros at some rate. And it takes some amount of time to cross that line. And then the computer on the other side takes some time to figure out what to do with it, and then it can send it on to the next stop. Or, if that computer was the destination, it can keep it. Clear? Okay. You see, we don't use PowerPoint, we don't have anything for it. Now, if I have the mail service, that's a packet network. What I do is I take my information, divide it into packets, which we will call letters, put the letter into a routing indicator, which we will call an envelope, and put it into the network. Which one I don't worry about anymore until it comes out of the network, wherever it was going, and gets read, and then they can send me back a letter if they want to. So that's a packet. So we have many letters from many different people, all moving on the same truck, or all moving in the same airplane, even though they're not going to the same place. They'll get scattered again later. Yeah? So I get very efficient use of my truck, or my airplane, because I've divided the information up into very small pieces. Contrast that with the telephone system. With the telephone system, when I call you on the phone, I get a circuit that goes from here to Chillicothe and from Chillicothe to New Orleans. And so I'm using up these two circuits, and until I hang up, nobody else can call. So sometimes you get a busy signal, but it's not because the person you're calling is on the phone. It's because the lines from here to Chillicothe were tied up, and somebody was calling New Orleans. Even though you just wanted to talk to somebody in Chillicothe, they were already using the line. So you get beep, 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 the fast, busy signal that means all circuits are busy. So that's circuit switch. So in the early days of computers, they said, hey, you know, however long the thing you want to send it is, we can just chop it up. I mean, just imagine if you wanted to send a book to somebody by FedEx, and FedEx had a limit, they wouldn't take something that weighed more than a pound, what would you do? Just take the book, tear it up into pieces, send the pieces, let them, maybe chapters, let them put it together there. Wouldn't be quite as good, but if it's bits, who cares, right? We'll chop the bits up into pieces, we'll send the bits, we'll number them. Yeah, people used to do this, right? Letter number one, letter number two, and they're Civil War letters, right? Right, people number them. So that's what those computer numbers, they'll put the routing indicator on it, which has got an IP address that it's going to, puts a sequence number on it, sends the bits, pops it into the network, winds its way through the network, and it gets there out of order. Maybe. Maybe one of them gets there fast, one gets there slow. Maybe one packet never gets there. Well, after a while, you see that you're missing letter number 42. You send back a message that says, I'm missing letter number 42, as long as it works reasonably reliable, it has a good chance of getting there. And they say, oh, you didn't get letter number 42 here, I kept a copy, I'll send it to you again. Because, you know, they're bits, you can just make them again. Yes? Anybody watch Warriors of the Net?
Yeah.
You like it? So, it's a nice animation of how these things get chopped up and sent. Okay, so, step one, we have to chop things up into packets. How big the packet is depends on how fast our network is. So there's some standard for how big the packet should be before they start slowing things down. Okay, so everything we're going to do is packet switch. Now, I told you this sort of, how is this really going to work, story about routing tables and how we're going to get things from South Africa to Zimbabwe, and you're like, I just want to get it through here to there. Like, well, we don't need all that fancy stuff. So we're going to come up with a simpler way of doing it if we're all nearby. We're just going to shout. Be like a cocktail party. We'll all talk at the same time. But we're going to talk really fast. So we'll finish very quickly. There's a really good chance that nobody else will start shouting while we're shouting. So what we do, we take one cable and we wire it between all these computers so that any time your computer wants to send something, you just shout. And if it doesn't get there, well, because somebody else shouts at the same time, too bad. Wasn't guaranteed. You didn't pay much for it anyway. Right? So this is called Ethernet. So we've got some speed Ethernet, maybe a 10 megabit per second Ethernet. Everybody's got an Ethernet card. We plug the same Ethernet into all of these. They all plug into a hub, and the hub just wires everything together. Everybody's shouting on the same network. That wouldn't work too well if we had all 6 billion people on the planet shouting at the same time. So it's okay in a room. Might work in a university. Probably won't work very well in a city. So at some point it gets too big, and we have to have some other way of doing it. So what we do is we say, okay, I'm going to have one computer sitting here that'll look for people who are shouting that they want to talk to somebody in Cleveland, or any place that's not here. And it does by looking at the beginning of the prefix of the IP address. That says, oh, here's a packet that's destined for somebody that's not going to hear the shout because they're not here. But I know how to get it to them because I got a routing table. And then they're connected by some very expensive line to Chillicothe and to London. And then they have to decide for each packet, do I send it to Chillicothe or to London? Except the computer doesn't know what London means, doesn't know what Chillicothe means. It just knows it's got some prefix. And some prefixes, you're better off sending it to Chillicothe. And other prefixes, you're better off sending it to London. And it doesn't even know that. It just knows that this place thinks they can get to these IP addresses quickly, and this place thinks they can get to those IP addresses quickly. With me? Better the second time? Okay. So, a local area network is a network on a scale where we could shout if we wanted to. And a wide area network is a network where we're going to have to pay for point-to-point connections and do routing. Okay? Now, if I were to connect a set of wide area networks together, I would get internet. I'd be able to route things from one wide area network to the other wide area network, which is where internet comes from. Right? So the idea of routing is inherently tied up with the idea of the Internet Protocol address. The Internet Protocol is the protocol that supports routing between networks. Internet, by the way, is a proper noun referring to the one global interconnected network. But you can use the same technology on an office network that's not connected to anything. And so people have taken to calling that an intranet.
between rather than, or within rather than between. Incorrect. Ethernet was the original shouting protocol. It was originally done on pairs of wires called twisted pair, or T for short. And it was done without any form of, they call modulation. So it was done at baseband. You send a high voltage for one, no voltage for zero. So if it was 10 megabits per second, people would say 10 base T. Right, 10 megabits per second baseband twisted pair. If you want to run very quickly, you need fancier wires. And so then you could get gigabit Ethernet, 100 times as fast as 10 base T. Now that's 10 megabits per second, which is about 1 megabyte per second. Okay. It turns out if everybody talks at the same time, nobody gets through. So if I ask how much are people trying to move on this network, then there's some limit beyond which we just get congestion and nobody gets through. That limit turns out to be at about 50%. Below 50%, most of the things make it through. Above 50%, people are constantly retransmitting, and so it gets carried away quickly. So the practical capacity of a gigabit per second internet is really half a gigabit per second. Right, that's the maximum rate, but the maximum rate can't be used when everybody's shouting. This is what cable modems use. Cable modems are something on the order of 10 megabits per second, and they're shared, which means that the signal that goes to your house is the same as the signal that goes to your neighbor's. So if you want to see if your neighbor is looking at pornography, you just reprogram your IP address to be your neighbor.
No.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, do you know cable modem?
No.
That's your neighbor?
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. So that's how cable modems work, right? So we're using the IP address, and everybody's deciding to play nice. You won't impersonate anyone else. Think how much that would screw up the network. You won't sniff the packets that are going to someone else. But maybe you're the FBI. No, I didn't do that. You don't think they would, do you? It's not a lot of court order.
But you'd have to know your neighbor's IP address, right?
You would.
And that's not something that, like, normally. How would I find that out?
Well, because the IP address is being sent by everybody who's sending them anything.
Right, but it's my neighbor, and I've never met them, and they never sent me anything.
Yes. You just see 10 things going by. You have to guess which one is your name.
Okay. Yeah.
Like when they type their name into some form. And you guess they were your name. Unless they were impersonating your neighbor, too. Okay. So, the security is by everybody playing this. Yes? Otherwise, anybody could look at what anybody else is doing. And if I wanted to see what was going on your computer, it'd be really easy. Just put a little sniffer on the network, and I could reconstruct all the packets that were coming to your computer. I couldn't request retransmission, because then I'd really screw you up. I could get most everything that's going to be over here. Okay, so that's how Ethernet works. Well, the problem is this shouting business doesn't work when everybody's doing streaming video, because the streaming video takes a lot of bandwidth. So everybody's shouting constantly, so we fill up the networks right away. So NASA's got this wonderful network that, you know, streams television and shows all the space launches. Guess what all the NASA employees do right before a space launch? Tune into the television network on their internet. On the desktop computer, right? Guess what happens to the entire network at NASA? So, bad deal. So what they've been doing is running around the university lately, tearing out all this old Ethernet shouting business, and putting in routers that route directly to you, and directly to you. And so now it comes into the router, and I've got a line U and a line U coming off the router, and we're the only people sharing that line. Now I can send you a gigabit a second with no interference from anybody else. But now I've got to pay extra for the router. So when routers were expensive, this was a bad deal. But as routers get cheaper, this becomes a better deal. This was, because your computer probably has an Ethernet card in it,
I'll simply send you using the same Ethernet protocol, but nobody else will be shouting, so we never have a problem. It's called switched Ethernet. That's what DSL uses. Private line from the phone company. So now if I want to sniff your phone line, I have to go to the phone company. And instead of the phone company, then I can see everything that's going to you and everything that's going to everybody else if I'm inside the phone company. So I have to get inside the phone company or upstream from that. I can't be on your block. Because your line goes from your house to the phone company without going through anybody else's house. That is the goal of the phone company.
And the fluctuations in speed will be based on what I'm looking at, not...
So then the fluctuations in speed can't be on the line between you and the phone company, because there's nobody else calling, unless there's somebody else in your house. Or if your neighbor had been paying for internet service, and then they realized that you had bought a wireless router, which would do the same thing except without plugging in at all, then anybody could connect through the air to your computer, at which point they could slow you down by watching the Super Bowl on the internet while you were trying to do useful work, right? But of course you could then defeat them by encrypting your, by what?
By
encrypting your connection so that your side has to know the password and the router has to know the password. And the password can't be guessed. So you wouldn't like use your name for it or something. Or your house number. Or something that you read outside. Yeah.
So DSL is wireless.
No, DSL is wired.
Okay.
But you can take the wire that comes in and connect it to a wireless router inside your house.
Right, but so if you have wireless in your house, then most likely you have DSL that works.
No. No. So I have to have the internet coming into my house, and then I have a wireless router.
Right.
And then I can be wireless after that.
Okay.
But something has to be plugged in there. That could be a cable modem. It could be DSL. It could be 5 or 10 other things. You could buy an internet node and stick it in your living room. Geeks used to do this. So any way of getting the internet into your house on a wire, and then you can broadcast all your internet around. In fact, if you don't have a password on your wireless, then your neighbors have a really easy time seeing what you're doing, because everything's being broadcast through the air.
So you're saying I have cable internet and I have wireless router with no password.
With a password.
With password all set up.
Yep.
That my neighbors can look at what I'm doing with their cable.
That's right.
I don't have your IP
address.
Well, yeah, but.
Or if they can guess what
they're
IP.
Let's assume my neighbors were like super anxious and could see this stuff out pretty quickly.
Yes. Then they're watching what you're doing. And it's illegal for them to do that.
Yeah.
It's also illegal to
steal internet. Well, yeah, it's illegal to do
that.
It's not really that simple. I mean, they might be left with the impression that somebody can just drive by your house and set up a computer without having any knowledge of how to do any of that and get into your computer.
No, it's not. The without any knowledge part is not the...
Okay. So they have to know how to get...
They have to have taken 690, right? Well, remember what I said about being able to install application software?
Mm-hmm.
You have a machine. It's connected to the internet. You could install some software and reprogram your machine to do any of these things, couldn't you?
But
nobody will.
A little more than probably. Right. You never know who your neighbors are.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Did I answer the question? What was the difference between DSL and cable modem in a sufficiently memorable way?
Yeah.
Good. Good deal. Okay.
I have another hypothetical.
Yep.
So we set up a unsecure or insecure wireless network in order to lure in people to steal from it to watch what they do.
Yes. You could. It's called bait. In fact, you'll notice when you're in an airport sometimes, you're trying to get wireless, and you'll see some free internet something or other, and you connect to it, and it doesn't really work.
Mm-hmm.
And then you notice that pretty soon thereafter, your virus checker starts telling you about viruses.
Mm-hmm.
This actually happened to me. And it's because at one point you told the system to connect to that, and that's another computer, and they're just waiting for you to connect.
and then they'll just go running through your hard drive and take and file the antivirus to it, right back to your hard drive.
Yeah. Don't connect to network two, don't trust.
Good enough.
And invest in a virus checker. All right. What's a virus?
Corruption in your program makes it not work properly, right?
So how do I know the difference between a virus and a computer program? Well, I could have a virus that replicates and sends on to somebody else, whereas, well, I could have lots of programs send things on. I could have an email program that sends things on to other people.
But it doesn't install in there. Like, if I send an email to somebody, unless they open it, it doesn't install anything on their computer.
Well, that's how a lot of viruses
right.
work. You open the attachment and
yeah, but I have, but sometimes when I open a file and it automatically runs something for me, it's what I wanted. It's a little picture of dancing elves or something, you know. Lots of people get programs auto-installed that they want. Click here to download. You click here, it installs. So what's the definition of harm? How would I know if the program is harming something? Programs just do what they're programmed to do. So yes, there's a social definition of a virus. But from a computer program standpoint, a virus is simply a computer program. It does what it's supposed to do. It's simply doing something you don't want done. So a virus is entirely in your mind. Right? I mean, the only thing that makes it a virus is you don't like what it's doing. What's that? Well, a lot of things you didn't ask for that you get, your clock updates all the time, doesn't it? But you don't mind that. You seem to like that. There are lots of things that you don't ask for and you get. So the only way to tell if it's a virus is social. The infrastructure to detect viruses is a registration of bad programs. That's what happens. You register bad programs. You note their characteristics. You have this trade in bad programs. Blacklisted programs. It's just like what was going on in Hollywood in the 1950s, right? With blacklisting actors and blacklisting writers and blacklist programs. Because they don't do what we want them to. The social control of the computer. Okay. So you got the idea that we've got a shared network. The original Ethernet was this way. Right, it's really, really flexible. I don't have to run a new wire from the router when you install a new computer. I can just put a hub in and send things into it. This is what's used in switch internet now. So for this, I need a really fast switch, which used to be really expensive, but they've gotten pretty cheap. So this is probably what you have at home. If you've got a wireless router, it'll have several places to plug in. Wireless networks, there are two kinds, computer to computer and access points. The access points plug into the bigger world. They're what you think of when you think of a wireless network, but you can make a wireless network that's just computer to computer. It's essentially just a radio-based Ethernet. Everybody's just out there shouting. It's gotten to be called Wi-Fi. For wireless high fidelity, but it doesn't have any more fidelity than anything else. It's ones and zeros. It's just fast. How fast is it? 10 megabits per second. Now, why is it 10 megabits per second?
Because it's probably going back to DSLR cable.
Yeah, because if I've got a 10 megabit per second thing to plug it into, that's about as fast as I want my radio signal to go. But then, as the wired internet got faster, the speed of the radio connection became the limit. So these are the ones you can buy today. They have these weird names. So people call these now wireless B, wireless G, wireless N. They're like, what happened to wireless C? Right? But these are just a whole series of standards that people came up with. They leave out IEEE 802.11 because nobody can remember it. If you want to run video, you need wireless G, which is what you buy today. But if you have an old wireless router, it might be B. Right, or if you have an old laptop, it might be the B's can use a G router, they just run slower. And there's a new one coming along, M. Now when I connect my cell phone to my laptop, it doesn't go over 802.11. That uses a lot of power. It goes over instead Bluetooth, which is a short, up to like 10 meters or 30 feet, short range connection. Runs at about the same speed as Bluetooth. And when you see people walking around with Mr. Data things on, right? That's usually Bluetooth down to here. And so as long as your pocket is within 10 feet or 30 feet of your ear, you're probably okay. Questions on wireless?
Yeah.
Well, that probably wouldn't be a good idea. Wireless tends to interfere with other wireless. There's a limited number of radio frequencies. So when I'm at home, my next door neighbors have a wireless. Our systems are supposed to find different frequencies. So if somebody goes by in their car with a wireless, they might be on the same frequency as one of us, so I might have a little interruption of service. When I use wireless in my kitchen, which is a long way away from my computer room, I get slower transfer rates than I get when I'm in the computer room. So if I'm going to do a file transfer, I'll bring the computer into the computer room. If I'm going to do a really big file transfer, you know, one that might take 5 minutes, I'll connect it wired so that I get the higher transfer rate, 100 megabits per second, and I get no variations, because sometimes when the wireless changes frequencies or something, it'll drop for a second and break whatever the software was transferring. I'll have to start it over again. So wired is much, much more stable and reliable. The wireless is really good for, I get home, I push the on button, I stick the computer in the kitchen, I can check my email while I'm cooking. I mean, constantly I go into the other room to do something and I come back like half an hour later and I smoke alarms going off and stuff. So, you know, it solved that problem. Okay? So, wireless and wired will live side by side for a long time. Also, some computers don't have wireless modems. I have a computer I bought 20 years ago, 10 years ago. Could have a wireless modem in it. It works fine when I want to transfer something. It's just, I mean, you can't carry it around, it weighs 100 pounds. So it doesn't matter. Unless you plug the wire in. Okay. So our campus runs on a ring network where people that are here, my office, who want to send stuff over to the computer and space sciences building over there, they just connect it down to the campus ring and it gets sent over to here. If this doesn't know what to do with it, it doesn't need a routing table. It just sends it to here, some other building, maybe Williams. If it doesn't know what to do with it, it sends it to here. I mean, it's going someplace on campus. It just keeps shipping it around in a circle until it gets there. Right. If it's going off campus, there'll be a router sitting here at some point, but it'll recognize it's going off campus. So it's just a ring network. It gets up. It's a bunch of point-to-point networks, but without a routing table, because everything just moves around the ring until it finds out where it's going. Here's a confusion a lot of people have. What's the internet?
We need the entire makeup of networks put together?
Yeah, it's a bunch of networks connected together. Nothing else. It's a bunch of networks connected together. Now, if I ask you what the World Wide Web is, you'd say, oh, it's the thing I can search with Google. Like, well, if there wasn't an internet, that stuff couldn't all get to Google. Google couldn't get you the information. There's certainly an internet in here someplace, right? But the internet's the component. The World Wide Web is what we do. So come back next week, we'll do the World Wide Web. Right. But it's quite common for people to say, oh, I found it on the internet. Okay, I mean, you found it using the internet. The internet is, you know, what do I say? I found it on the electricity. Using the electricity. The
was on the television. Okay. So, you already know the bad news, right? Who made up the internet? The military. Remember this from last week? Why did they make it up? Because Chillicothe might get blown up during the phone call. Alright? And the next packet had to go some other way. So, this bit about routing tables I was telling you about, that's not small stuff. My routing tables have to be able to redecorate themselves, send stuff in different ways when a line fails. Usually not because of a nuclear explosion in Chillicothe. The most common reason is because of a failure of a computer in Chillicothe. A power failure in Chillicothe. The phone lines to Chillicothe are out because of a storm. At a global scale, this is going on constantly. So the internet's constantly sitting here retweaking its routing tables. How does it do that? Just by asking the people nearby, send me your routing table. Then I find out what the internet looks like from their standpoint. I construct what it looks like from my standpoint and send it back upstream to everybody else. It's not really upstream or downstream, it just flows around. Okay? So this is really old, it's 7 years old. But you can see that the high population density here in the Northeast, the high population density here in the West, created a market for densely interconnected networks in the Northeast and in the West, and fairly sparsely interconnected networks in like the top of the Rocky Mountains. The surprise since then has been that it used to be that if you wanted to go to Hawaii, you had to go up to a satellite and come back down. Because once I put the satellite up, just have to put up more ground stations to send more traffic up and down, or bigger radios. But it actually turns out to be better for the internet if I could run undersea cables to Hawaii, if I could run undersea cables over to Europe. And so what happens is there are a relatively small number of extremely expensive undersea cables that run off the east coast of the United States over to Europe, that run off the west coast of the United States over to Asia. Hawaii actually has made itself sort of a data center, so a lot of stuff runs into Hawaii and back out. There's a lot of north-south traffic. And so there are a small set of places that if you cut the cable, it's not that you can't get there from here anymore, but now you have to route through places that are already pretty busy, that are already, don't have very thick pipes, don't have a cable that will carry a lot of traffic. And so then what happens is you get a lot of contention for those networks, and that's what happened to the internet last week. Was once you lose one part of the global infrastructure, everything else tries to route around it, but it creates a set of places that become bottlenecks. And so if you want to design an internet, then what you want to do is you want to figure out where those bottlenecks might occur and put extra capacity in a few key places. And so there are people that go back looking afterwards and they say, well, what kind of problem might we have here? What kind of problem might we have there? For the way the thing happened to get built, and then try to build extra capacity, sort of the shunts around it. And that's what people that work on networking try to do, is they try to do mathematical analysis of the traffic flows. So we've talked about these a little bit. We've talked about routers a lot. A gateway is the formal name of the router that routes off of a local area network. So if I have a router and a switched Ethernet, or if I have a router as a gateway, those are both routers. Router is the generic term. That means it's doing switching. It reads the IP address and decides where to send it based on a routing table. Gateway is a place that has a big routing table and sends out to the big bad internet. Whereas the local router, switched Ethernet, has just got a little table with everybody here and everybody else without that. Some routers are smart. So if you haven't watched Warriors of the Net, you have to watch. It's way cool.
But there's, you know, there's some point in there where the router that's the firewall, looking at the packet as it comes through, it's like, blows it up. So, you know, there are bad people that figured out how to do things to your computer that your computer's not programmed to protect against. So they just, the router is really just another computer. They program it to do nothing except look for bad packets and kill them. And that's what a firewall is. Firewall is a kind of a router. Right, and it's more selective than what it passes. A general term router means it'll pass it. If you tell it where it's going, it's a trusting source. A firewall is a suspicious router. And often if you buy a personal router, you'll get a firewall.
I just have a question about spyware and where that fits in between viruses and firewalls.
Okay, so spyware is to some extent a virus because it is behaving in a way you don't want it to behave. So, but the term has been applied to, all these names are just names people made up, but what it is you download some software and it collects information about you and sends it home to wherever its home is. You know, like, let's say you wanted to know where people were surfing on the web. You could start a company, build a browser, give it away for free, let people use it, and it wouldn't do anything harmful except every time they went to a new web page, it'd send you the URL. Then you'd see how long they're spending on it, you know, which web pages they were seeing. Do you ever wonder why Microsoft gives away browsers for free? No. Anyway, so that's what spyware is. Spyware is I give you a product you'll value. I'm not claiming that. I give you a product you'll value. You use it, and it sends me information that you might not want to have sent. Now, if I put a little block on there that says, may we have your permission to watch what you do. So for example, Google has a toolbar you can put on, and before you can install the toolbar, you have to say, you have to answer the question, do you mind if we watch over your shoulder and keep track of what you do so we can give you better service? And if you say, yes, I mind, they say, fine, you can't have the toolbar. But if you want, but if you say, yes, it's fine, then they watch what you're doing, and the advertisements you get are advertisements appropriate to you more often than they would be otherwise. Right, that's their goal. Then they sell that to their advertisers. They say, we have a better set of eyeballs to sell you than the other people. How do we do it? Because we give them this product of value and they give us permission to do this. That's not normally called spyware because you agreed. It was the explicit contract. Now, if I give you exactly the same software, except in line 42 of the 375 line thing, there's an agreement on your part to allow your information to be shared, and you click I agree, legally that's identical. But then people would consider it to be spyware because it's not really informed consent. It wouldn't pass, you know, the Health and Human Services review of, you know, human subjects. Because I didn't do, I it's obscured consent, right? So it's okay for lawyers, but not okay for research. So people then call that spyware. There's no technical difference. Okay? All right. So this is the real structure of the internet. It is a set of internal networks. Now, I call this an intranet here. And if this is an intranet, then I wouldn't want it connected to the public internet. But what we can do, we can forget about the public internet. We can buy a line from here to there, and I can have my office in Zurich connected with my office in Manhattan by this leased line without the public internet. Yeah. Nothing gets routed to the public internet. Public internet can't be in, I can't be out. That's really expensive. I better be like a really big company. And what these people are doing in Zurich better be real important. There's a cheaper way to do this. What I'll do is I'll say, look, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to buy an internet connection, but nobody can use it.
only people who can use it are these people here. So all this stuff's private. This person here can talk to the internet. This person here can talk to the internet. The only people they'll talk to on the internet are each other. And they're going to get a Buck Rogers secret decoder ring. And every time they have a packet to send, they'll dial the decoder ring around. They'll set the encrypted message over to the other side. They get out their same decoder ring, decrypt the message, and pass it on to their network. This isn't a private network anymore, but it's a virtual private network, yes? So it involves having the VPN, virtual private network software, here and here, that does encryption of the traffic that's being routed off of this internet onto that internet. And now what I have is I have a virtual single intranet. It's not one network, but it acts like it is. Now, let's say that this is the University of Maryland's campus, which is connected to the internet, but we'll ignore that. Okay? And this is you. Not, there's no network over here, it's just you sitting in a hotel room in Frankfurt. And you want to use some resources here that anybody on campus can use, like at the library. So what do? You set up a VPN software to connect to a VPN host here at the university, so you can download this from OIT tonight. And then it's just as if you're sitting at the university. Every packet you send goes encrypts through the network to there, where it gets decrypted, and then used. And so if you ever get on a network where you can't do what you want, just fire up your VPN to a VPN connection back home, and then do everything from home. It doubles the network traffic because you got to get the network, the traffic to there, and then blast it back out. Yeah?
So I'm a GA here at UMBC, and I'm also at UMBC and Michelle.
Mm-hmm.
And I dial, I get onto the VPN when I'm in Michelle.
Mm-hmm.
But I still have to put in my password for the library databases when I'm on a College Park campus, when I don't have to when I'm on the UMBC campus.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I can access the network, I still have to do.
Yeah, so the example I gave you, I lied, because the people at the library figured out that what was going on was people that weren't affiliated with the university were building VPN connections into the university and doing this. And so they disabled that one computer for automatic access. So what you have to do is install VPN software on any other computer in the university, and don't tell them I told you. But that's just the configuration part of it. They're okay. They're protecting their license agreement against an obvious attack.
So, just so I get this right in my head, this is pretty much like the remote access. Like if we're at home and we want to look at one of the research port databases and we put in our password and everything, that's what this is?
Research port's doing it a different way. This would be if you wanted to act like you were on campus. So, for example, there are certain things that only computers that are on campus can do. Right, I mean, people are looking at who's connecting to me, and if they're from off campus, they just won't let them do it. This lets you be virtually on campus. It's more important for a company that has, their email can only be read inside the company. So you connect remotely to the company. But I don't want my email moving across the network to you, because it might have company secrets in it, there might be people sniffing on the network. You know, you might be having a business meeting at one of our competitors.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this virtual private network that does the encryption of everything that comes back into the company. So that's where it comes up more than at the university, where everything's open at the university. But the financial management stuff at the university works this way. All your grade reporting works this way. What, how to change your grade?
No, why exactly would you be doing that you would need?
Financial management grade, the central business operations at the university runs. And you couldn't, 30,000 students, you can't write this. They actually tried. This was the first setup they had. It just completely failed. You know, they just said, oh, everybody install a VPN, and it'll be fine. You can use all the library resources.
Right.
Uh-oh. Yes?
Just because a VPN is encrypted, that doesn't mean it can't necessarily be hacked, correct?
Well, that's a really good question. That's a really good question. So what does it mean to encrypt something?
I mean, if I have a buck rusher secret decoder ring, the easiest way for you to break the code is to go get me and rip the goddamn thing off my finger. And then you've got the decoder, right? So, I mean, all of the fancy ways of protecting these things don't work if I get the key. Yeah, that's perfect. The second thing is that the key is just a number that gets put into a computer program that's used to decode that. Well, you could guess numbers all day, and sooner or later you'd guess the key. And then you could see if the thing was going back and forth looked like things that normally go back and forth, because they look like they have IP addresses and that sort of thing, right? So you could tell when you guessed the key right. Well, then the question is, how big a number do I have? So, you know about 128-bit encryption? Mm-hmm. The strong encryption? And 64-bit encryption? Neat encryption? Minty encryption? Yeah? Well, what makes it strong? Well, it's how long it takes to guess the number. So how long does it take to guess the number for 128-bit encryption? Longer than for 64-bit encryption. Quite a bit longer. Well, how long? Well, it kind of depends on how fast your computer is, right? Remember that Moore's Law thing? Mm. Computers are getting faster. So what encryption protects you against is somebody guessing the key for a while. And if I make the key longer, we can protect for a longer time. But I don't think we can protect for all time, and we have no way of protecting against lucky guesses. So there's only some very small chance somebody will guess the key on the first try. I mean, very, very, very small, but if they do, you're out of luck. So the assurance is statistical. The assurance requires physical assurance. That's why if your password is your house number, you're in trouble. Because then I don't have to guess the key, I just have to guess your house number, right? And that's actually the biggest source of weakness in any of this. And the assurance is vulnerable to Moore's Law. Now, how much assurance do you want to provide? Well, you want to provide enough assurance to keep it safe for, I don't know, let's say 100 years. We don't know what's going to happen for 100 years, so let's plan for 500 years, and then we'll see if it's okay. So that's what you do. And then a bunch of clever mathematicians, having nothing better to do, try to come up with clever algorithms to guess the key. You know, I'll name that 2 and 4 notes. Right? So there's a sort of an arms race.
It's more like a really good deterrent.
Yes, foolproof. Everything's a really, really, really good deterrent. Only foolproof things are not to say. And even that's not foolproof. What? Okay.
Yeah, I think it's simple, but the two red dots aren't actually connected just to each other, is it?
Well, they're only virtually connected to each other. They're not really connected to each other at all.
When you send the information through the VPN, it actually goes through the public internet.
Yeah, that's right. It's not really connected. It should have been a dot. Other questions? Yeah.
You were saying that you could pretty much get around having to log into ResearchPort with a VPN by sending VPN on another computer.
It was a really bad example of that lie, right? Because they've got this thing that specifically won't allow that. But yes, I could put a VPN on my office machine, and then it would work.
Okay.
You're going to try it,
aren't
you?
No.
It's not illegal.
A VPN is one that you can download?
Yes, for money.
I was also, didn't say it was expensive?
It is. Cisco still. But you can do it. Or you could program one yourself. It's a little harder to download. Did you wrote? Oh, really? Okay. So, let's take a 5-minute break. Scratch, we'll do calisthenics outside. And then we'll come back in, and we've got half an hour to finish up. Thank you. It is nice.
And that's not going to be, and then, come on, I have a guy who comes with my computer stuff for me. He filled out the form or whatever, and so it's like, you have on the form, what kind of idea do you have? So,
I have to ask this question.
I have to make a question.
Yep, this is a good question. This is a good question. Okay, Elizabeth accuses me of lying. She says that I said that every computer on the internet has an IP address, and the book says they don't really. Because they're these dynamic IP addresses. So you don't really like own one, you rent them. Right? So how do you get a dynamic IP address? Well, there's an IP address server that gives out IP addresses. There aren't enough IP addresses for everybody, so I can't give you one when you buy your computer. So what you do is your computer has an Ethernet address, a MAC address, M-A-C address, not the MAC. And that address is hardwired into your computer. And then your computer requests from the DHCP server, which is at some well-known address, an IP address, which you're given. So when you go home and you're on Comcast and you turn on your computer, it goes through, and one of the things, which are on your router, whatever's plugged into the internet, one of the things it does is it requests an IP address, and then that IP address gets leased to you.
And you have some lease duration that's kept track of by the system.
Yeah.
And then I think the thing that Elizabeth and I were trying to figure out, something with a dynamic IP, does that change every single time you log on?
That changes every time you go to the DHCP server and ask for another one. So when I bring my laptop onto the network, it gets a different IP address every time I do that. And that's only a problem if somebody wants to remember my IP address, right? So that they can connect to me later. Like if they want to send me something using my IP address. So I have to have some way of registering my IP address so that people know which IP address corresponds to me, right? I need a yellow pages or something, or white pages, you know, where you can take me and find my phone number. You need somebody to take me and find my IP address. So now we have this other problem. I have to have some way of having a name that can be looked up in this. And of course, these being computers, they don't do most ambiguity, so you want it to be a unique name. So this is where this www.umd.edu thing comes from. That name corresponds to an IP address, and there's some white pages service that looks that up that's called the domain name service, or DNS. Okay? So domain names are designed because people can't remember 64 bits, people can't remember four numbers, but people can remember domain names. So they're just there for your own convenience. You can always just type the IP address in, if you happen to know.
But that's when you have a static IP address, right?
Well, or a dynamic one that you know right now. The IP address is used to route things to you soon. It's dynamic, it's not changing every 30 seconds. It's changing every time you turn your computer on. So it's good for all that.
But you can leave your computer on for a week and never turn it off, and you're connected to the internet the whole time it's just been locked. I'm still wondering how something knows to get to you the next time you turn the computer on.
Because your computer isn't a well-known place. Nobody's going to your computer. Your computer is always asking for things. When it asks for things, it says who it is.
Okay.
And if who it is has changed since last time, that's probably good, because that way they can't keep track of you. Otherwise, you know, they'd be spying on you. Maybe they're spying on you anyway. Maybe they found another way. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So there's a really funny way these phone books work. I couldn't have a phone book of everybody on the internet. I mean, just think, every year they have to publish a new phone book, right? And then when new numbers come out, I have to call like directory assistance. The internet always works with directory assistance. There's no phone book. So what they do is they just keep the directory assistance data, and every time you go to a web page, the name gets looked up and converted to a number. Every single time. So every computer in here knows the address of a domain name server. Not by name, by number. It's got to know where to look. It's got to have some number for something, right? So it's got a number for the domain name server. And in fact, in case the domain name server breaks, it's got a number for a second domain name server. And when you configure an address, IP connection manually, you have to type both of these in. And they're 192.8.8.42 or something. DNS, primary DNS, secondary DNS, right? Now that's your lowest level domain name server. And if that domain name server can resolve what you're looking for, it gives you the answer. If it can't, it goes to its supervisor. Just like in the old days. All right? So it goes to a higher level domain name server. So if you ask for, you know, snagglepost.com, then it'll go to the .com name server and find snagglepost. But the .com name server is way up from the .edu. You're down here at .edu. So you go up to the TT class server. The TT class server goes up to the UMD server. The UMD server goes up to the EDU server, which goes across to the .com server, which goes down to the snagglepost server. So you have to look in a whole slew of servers. So one server tells you where to find the next server that can help you to answer this question. There's a whole lot of traffic going on just to do the domain name resolution. And then, just like any sensible person would do, it sticks it in a scratch pad in case it might need this same one again. Because if you send something there once, you might send something there again, like the next packet. And we call the scratch pad what? Cache. Every time we have the idea that we'll just hold something here locally, the general idea is called cache.
Okay?
And that's why sometimes you log into things and you know you're using the right last name and password and all the sort of stuff. So but you can't get in and you can hold it and hold passwords and cash.
Yes, but that's a different use of cash. Hold that for next week. Because all I'm doing here is the plumbing of the network. So the domain name service has the IP address that corresponds to that domain name in cache. So that can cause a failure to bring up the page if it flips IP addresses and you don't clear your cache. But that's the worst thing that could happen. Okay, so if you'd like to have some fun, on whatever computer you're on, follow along with me. Go to start, and then run, and it should bring up this little run thing down here, and type CMD. And it should bring up a little window that looks very retro. And type IPCONFIG, IP, all one word, config, CONFIG, space, slash, I think this is the silliest thing in the world. You're listening to somebody on TV reading you a URL and they say backslash, when what they mean is forward slash. And it would have been perfectly fine to say slash, but it sounds so much geekier to say backslash. This is a forward slash, a perfectly ordinary lower right-hand corner slash, all. I think it's space slash all. Yeah? And hit return. And you will get, you can pull this down if you want to see the whole thing, you will get some information about your IP configuration. For example, my host name is Plustit01. So if you wanted to connect to me right now, you would type ping plstt-01.umd.edu. And it sent a ping there, and it got a reply from 129.2.78.120. 1032 bytes, time was less than 1 millisecond. You remember I told you we had to measure the time to another server? 1 millisecond divided by 2 to talk to myself. No, it's okay. So that's my host name. My IP address is 129.2.78.120. And my DNS server, from which I did the resolution when I typed this tcclass, they're listed at 01, is at 128.8.74.2. If that didn't work, we'll try 76.2, and if that didn't work, we'll try 5.2. This is a dynamic IP address, so this changes when the computer gets logged on. You can see it's DHCP is enabled. DHCP enabled, yes. It was leased at 729.15 tonight, and it will be renewed at 829, so every hour it's renewing its IP address. Right. Demystifies what we've just been talking about. I mean, you have one of these in front of you. You can see it anytime using this. Okay? All right. Now, without getting rid of that, go to a web browser. So down at the bottom, you can just click on the E for Internet Explorer if you like. And then in the web browser, go to the address remote.12dt.com. Not www, it's remote.12dt.com. And it says, enter the IP address that you would like to find out the name of. So this is just like looking up somebody's phone number to see who they are. Right, and you can just, it pre-enters the IP address you connected from, because it knows who you are. That should make you nervous, actually. Whoever you connect to on the internet knows who you are. Now they must, because they routed the answer back to you, right? So you must have told them who you are and how to route things to you. So they know your IP address, but
There's no way they could know actually who you are unless they actually looked you up in the domain name service to find out that you're plfct01.uop.edu or whoever you are. Okay, so did that just make real some of the abstract stuff we've been talking about? It's all sitting in front of you. Your computer has it in it. It uses it to route things around, look things up. Yeah.
Wait, but if you disconnect from the internet and you go back on again, are you going to have a different IP address?
Yes.
But so I noticed that all our IP addresses are keep 143 on 144, keep 145. I mean, that's not coincidence.
Well, maybe that's the order they were turned on. There's somebody in there that's got a bunch of buttons. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Turns them on. Maybe it turns them on in a different order tomorrow. It'll all come up differently. Or maybe you're always getting the same one leased because the DHP server knows you and likes you and sends you the same one. But there's no technical reason why they need to be the same. Yeah.
I'm still getting email when
you're not working. Ah! That's like 5 weeks from now. So this is the plumbing of how the email would move to where it needs to go, but it doesn't say where it goes. So where it goes is to a server that your system connects to pull the email. So the server is always running even when your computer's off. The email's not going to you. It's going to the email server. Now that should make you nervous, because then if somebody comes along with a subpoena and they want all your email, they can just issue it to the people who run the server. All these policy issues. Yes?
If
you look at it,
how much of that registration
implementation
is necessary for?
You mean the fact that, is it really owned by the University of Maryland? It's a lovely question. And to answer the question, we have a homework assignment. And the homework assignment is to figure out whether the things that these people are telling you are true. So this is just an assertion. This is just a statement of responsibility. But you can actually watch the packets move through the internet and see where they go. And where they go is where their server really is.
So is that like sniffing
it? Well, no. It's a little like sniffing the internet along the route, but just it's sniffing something you send. It's just what happens is you send a packet to them, and every router in between sends you back how it's going. It's a sort of a return receipt requested packet for every router that it goes through. Here, let's see if we can do one of those. So this one's a little hard to type in, so I'll just demo it. So the program's called TraceRoute. And what did we say we are? PLFTT-01. UMD.edu. So this is from a server in South Africa. In fact, you can see the instructions here are in Afrikaans. And if it's working, yeah, here we go. So to get here, the last thing that it went through was gi1-1.css.dual-r1.net.umd.edu. You can see that that server is 296.427 milliseconds away from the server in South Africa. Is this bigger than a second or smaller than a second? How much smaller? What's that? It's a quarter second. Right? The 296 milliseconds? There would be 1,000 milliseconds in a second, so that's about a third. Quarter to a third of a second. Right? What the devil is one of the answers in the home? Okay, so before that went through this one, before that went through this one. Before that went through maxgigapop.net. It's kind of hard to tell from the names where these things are. Went through Internet 2, the Washington node of Internet 2. This doesn't have a name in the domain name server, so you get just a number. Went through New York City. Went through Amsterdam and the Netherlands. went through London and the UK. So from South Africa to London, then to Amsterdam, then to New York City. This is something in South Africa, and everything before that's in South Africa. Cool? Now, if you really wanted to have fun, you'd put it on a map. Right? You could watch your packets zap around the globe, and that's what you do for homework. Literally. You'll play with the version of this on a map. But you can go back to this one if that one doesn't make sense to you. Questions? Okay. So the fun thing about this class is it starts to be, you can do it. You can actually get it and play with it. And there's no math. How did I get to this?
Is it how we got to that website that we're tracing?
Or? We're tracing how, so I just connected to a server at this address at the bottom. So that's some computer in South Africa. And we're tracing how it packets get to me. Right, so what it did was it sent a packet to me, return receipt requested, it assembled the return receipt, and sent it to me, and built a web page and showed it to me. Okay. Well, one day this thing will flip. That's my own. If you had taken this course in computer science, we would have done it completely differently. We would have started out by saying, I have a line, and it's got ones and zeros moving on it. Right? And then I have a computer program that uses that line to send a message from here to there, a packet. And that packet is a set of ones and zeros, but it has a routing, and it's got a router, and it has an IP address. Right? Then I have a service above that that uses that service. So this is like those Russian dolls, right, that have dolls inside them. So at the very lowest level, there's actually a line. And then conceptually above that, there's some service that sends bits down the line and uses the router to route to select which line. And then above that, there's a service that converts the name of the place it's going into the IP address, the domain name service. And above that, there's a service that will allow me to make sure that my packet got there. So I send my packet, and I say, here's the first packet. And then later I send the second packet, but it doesn't get there. And then I send the third packet, and it gets there. It says, well, wait a minute, I never saw the second packet. And it sends a request back for the second packet. It doesn't have any idea what these packets assemble back to. It's just doing reliable packet delivery. So I'm reassembling the phone line. I'm making a virtual phone line with what's called the Terminal Control Protocol, or TCP. So guaranteed packet delivery. That doesn't guarantee how quickly it gets there, but it guarantees it gets there and in order at an even higher layer. So this is called the OSI reference model. This is a seven-layer model. At the very highest level, I have my application program that's using this service. Now, the reason why we don't do this here is because these are like castles built in the air, right? These things are just a story about what the computer programs are doing. We're just thinking of them as if they're levels. They're not really levels. They're just computer programs that use other computer programs. Because you can think of them as there's a low-level thing happening, a higher-level thing happening, or the very highest-level thing happening. So one of the services is called TCP. It's a connection-oriented service. I establish a connection to you, and then I can send packets, and I'm guaranteed they'll get there, but I'm not guaranteed when. Another service is UDP, a user datagram protocol. And I can send a packet, and it's the good luck service. It's like mailing a letter. If it gets there, it gets there. If it doesn't get there, how would you even know it was sent?
Which one is that?
UDP, like mailing a letter. TCP, like making a phone call. Okay? If my connection fails in TCP, I get a message that says connection failed. UDP, if it doesn't get there, nothing happens. Do you ever have a website where you click on something and nothing happens and you click on it again and you get what you're looking for? Mm-hmm. Well, that click went into a UDP packet. Got sent off. Nothing happened. It got lost in all the shouting or something. And so, you clicked again. I didn't have to guarantee delivery of your click. To set up a connection just to send your click would have been a big pain in the neck, but I could just send your click, and if it doesn't get there, you'll click again. Right? So I use UDP for that. What happens if I'm watching streaming video? Can I afford to miss a packet? No. So I'm going to use TCP, right? Wrong. Because I can't afford to wait forever either. Right? TCP guarantees delivery, but doesn't guarantee when. So when I do video delivery, UDP. And if I don't get a packet, I better be ready for that. So you ever watching a music video or something, and all of a sudden, and then it's going again? You dropped a few packets. Oh, well. You can live with it. I mean, for all you're paying for that internet connection. Well, if you can't live with it, buy a better internet connection. Okay? Okay, so you got TCP, UDP? Okay, here's the moral equivalent of RAID 5. Something for the end of the class that you could put down that you didn't understand. Let's say that I have a file, like the notes you've been taking, and I want to move them to another computer. Well, let's say I have a file in one place on my computer and I want to move it to another place on my computer. What do? I just drag it over there, right? Well, it doesn't really drag. I mean, there's no, you know, there's nothing stretching across the disk that's pulling the bits. What's happening is, I'm telling the computer, write it over here. Read it from there and write it to here. And then if I don't want to hear anymore, delete it from here. So delete it from read it from here, write it to there, then delete it from here. That's the real copy operation. You're dragging it is just a way of telling it to do that. Now let's say that I want to copy a file from one computer to another computer. Right? How would I go about doing that? Well, I'd simply build a graphical user interface that would have on it the file systems on both computers. I'd pick up a file in one, drag it to another, and that would instruct the computer, read it from here, and write it to there. Right? So we have such a thing. You go to Internet Tools. Now there are several of these for historical reasons, but the one that we use is the F-Secure SSH file transfer. You might have a different one in your home machine. So I'll launch this. I actually do this after class every night. This is how we get the video onto the web page. So then I get this desktop, and it's got my computer, and on my computer I can look at, you know, the C drive, just in the perfectly normal way, right? So I'm going to look at the M drive. These are the files in my M drive. Okay, then I can go to Quick Connect here. I can connect to a computer that I want to connect to, so I'll connect to my desktop computer. You can't do this. It asked me if I want to keep a fingerprint. This is for security, so it's encrypting everything. So I've got a local file system, that's on my machine. I've got a remote file system, and I can just pick up the local file system. So I'm going to pick up LDFG 708 from fall 1999, class 13, and I'll copy it down to here. And you can see now it's telling me it's copying, it's 34% done, 88% done, it's complete, and now when it redoes this, it should already be there. And if that was in date modified, there it is. Okay? So this is essentially the file explorer with two parts to it. And you can drag things across. You have to tell it who you are to log in, right? So this is how you get stuff home. your WAM account, wam.umd.edu, is a place that you can FTP to tonight if you have your phone. Now, that's all too easy, so we have a more complicated way. And you'll find it here in the slides. So normally we say things like, don't try this at home, but try this at home. So this is what students in an earlier era had to do, and I thought you might find it quaint. So you start the command window just like we did before. And now we're in the command window. And then you you just tell it what you want to connect to, some other file system, so FTP to ftp.umx. You actually can do this one, umd.edu. And it asks, who am I? And I say, anonymous. And it says, fine to be anonymous, but as your password, tell me who you really are. Well, I tell it, you truly deserve. And now I've told it who I am, and it says, okay, you can only do the things that guests can do. So I say, fine, I want to look in the directory pub. So I type pd pub. Now this is the old way of doing it, so you have to tell it where you want to go, and then you're there. You're there, now you can look around. If I type ls, ls will tell me what's there. So now I want to go to Gina, so cd Gina. Gina is somebody who used to teach this class. And then I can look around, but I won't bother. CDLBSC 690. And then CD, or I'm sorry, not CD, yes. HW, oops, I gotta do binary first. Binary, and then guest, HW, Apple, ONE, .ppt. And that will give you a PowerPoint file that is called homework1.ppt. Gina's first homework was that you had to copy that file using FTP that way, and then, you know, tell her what was in it. That guarantees that you had figured out how to do this. So just be glad it's not 1996 anymore, you can use the graphical version of this, but for everything you can do graphically, there's a command line analog, and often it's easier to use the command line analog when you want to do things repeatedly, because you can say, do things like this, star, or the graphical thing, you just have to do them all or put them in a folder or something like that. So FTP has a graphical version, which allows you to sort of see what's going on and think of it over here and over there. And then just like I was telling you that the computer scientists would build these castles in the air or these links between levels that didn't really exist, same thing here. You have two file systems. You can't really see either one of them, but you kind of hold them in your mind at the same time and then move them from place to another. And that's file system. Which is up here at the application layer in the castles in the air. Questions? Yes?
Could you, FTP programs, like the graphical kind, can just be downloaded off the web free, or
university OIT has got one you can download for free. There are a lot of them that are free that the university thought through. This one that I just used. Yes.
Is there anything beyond or newer than FTP?
Well, this is the secure version of FTP. So FTP is just if I want to move files from one computer to another. I don't know what would be beyond that. I mean, there are plenty of other things you can do, but to do this, it's sort of to survive the test. Would you take out a piece of paper, please, and answer the perpetual question? Yes, you can get half a piece of paper from the person next to you. But I'll take a very small piece of paper. You can have one piece of paper for the whole semester, particularly if you only have one word. Don't forget there's a layout. There are two labs this weekend. There's a lab with Rebecca on Saturdays at 11, and a lab with J. June on Sundays at 11. They're both in 2108.